الرسول الكريم وعلى آله وصحبه من استنى بسنته إلى يوم الدين. All praise is due to Allah and may Allah's peace and blessings be on His last Prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وسلم and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. This afternoon's topic, Introduction to Islam, is one which I will deal with not in the usual fashion, in the sense of identifying what are the pillars of Islam and what are the pillars of Iman, because this is really what is usually meant by introduction to Islam. What is the pillars of Islam, what makes a person Muslim and not, etc. What I will be looking at this afternoon instead is the foundation of, or the foundation on which, in all of the principles of Islam are based. That foundation consists of two basic principles. One of faith and the other of righteous deeds or righteous acts. And I would say that these two principles underlie everything in Islam. Everything that has been prescribed or described for us, for Muslims, depends on these two principles. When we actually look at the pillars of Islam, and the pillars of Iman, we have the five pillars of Islam and the six pillars of Iman. What we find is that this division, which was made by the Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, is a division which makes clear the two fundamental categories or principles underlying acts in Islam, that of faith and righteous deeds. Because the pillars of Iman, the six pillars of Iman, all describe things that Muslims are required to believe. And the pillars of Islam are the things that Muslims are required to do. That these two are inseparable, we know. If a person does not do the required pillars of Islam, praying five times a day, fasting, etc., this takes one out of Islam. And if a person does not believe in any of the pillars of Iman, that is, faith in God, and the books of Revelation, destiny, etc., if a person does not believe any of these, also, that takes them out of the bounds of Islam. So we have this principle that in Islam, faith and righteous deeds are inseparable. This is confirmed in Surah Al-Asr, which is one of the small chapters at the end of the Quran, commonly recited at the end of gatherings, wherein Allah says, وَالْعَصْرِ إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لَفِي خُسْرٍ إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ وَتَوَاصَوْا بِالْحَقِّ وَتَوَاصَوْا بِالصَّبْرِ. That is, by time, all of mankind is in a state of loss, except those who believe and do righteous deeds, and advise each other to be patient, and advise each other to be truthful, or to be behind the truth. But the point is, the third verse, except for those who believe and do righteous deeds. This phrase, amanu wa amilu salihat, believing and doing righteous deeds, is found throughout the Quran, from beginning to end. As description of the believers. Because of that, Muslim theologians, Muslim scholars have always held, vast majority of them have always held, that faith in Islam, faith, the general concept of faith, involves both the belief as well as action. That the two are inseparable. Belief and action constitute faith in Islam. And when we look at faith without, or we look at first, if we look at act without faith, where a person may do what is considered to be good or righteous, but there isn't faith there. This is common amongst the materialists, the people who do not recognize God or a higher supreme being, who don't feel any obligation to God or accountability for the act. They will do good in this life out of need. You will find, for example, this includes both the capitalist and the communist, both ends of the spectrum. You'll find people operating, doing good, but there is no faith behind it. And the good is really, you know, the good of the moment. What is convenient. For example, if a person works in a store, you know, a department store, you're going to work in a department store, you are instructed that when a customer comes, you must smile at the customer. You know, no matter what, the customer is talking at you with harsh words or whatever, you smile at the customer. No matter how you are feeling that day, you might have gotten up on the wrong side of the bed, you're feeling lousy, but when you come in there, you got to put that smile on your face. You know, and you have to treat them nice. Why? Because if you treat them nicely, they will come back again and buy some more goods. So that niceness has nothing to do, you know, it's not real, it's a false, it's a facade of right, of niceness. Same thing with, for example, communists. And the principle of, what do you call, democracy works on the same basis. Well, whatever the people, the masses of the people decide right and good, then this is right and good. But this can change. 5 years later, 10 years later, this can be described as being bad. There's no consistency there. There's no, it's so flexible that, as they say, you know, one man's food or good is another man's poison. One man's meat is another man's poison. What may be good for you may not be good for me. Good is relative. Relative to what is beneficial to you. You have philosophers, Western philosophers, to propose. And this is how we are to understand good. It's whatever is personally good for you, what is beneficial, what is pleasurable to you, what is good. Also, acts which don't have the correct faith, these are all and these acts may have good acts done by people, whether they be Buddhists, Hindus, Christians, whatever, because of the fact that their faith is incorrect, then those acts become useless in the sense of gaining them the reward of the next life. They're not totally useless in the sense that whatever good a person does, they will be rewarded for. But it will not give them paradise in the next life. The other way to look at, or the other side of the coin, that of faith without act. As I said, from an Islamic perspective, faith without act is
really not acceptable by God. Belief without the act belief demands, this belief is really not acceptable by God. This is why Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, العهد الذي بيننا وبينه الصلاة ومن تركه فقد كفر. That the distinction between us and the disbelievers is salah. Whoever abandons it has become a disbeliever. Whoever abandons salah, abandons prayer. When they say abandons prayer, it doesn't mean that they pray once a week or in Ramadan. No, it means abandons prayer that is established in Islam. Prayer for a Muslim is 5 times a day. You know, beginning at 5 o'clock in the morning, midday, mid-afternoon, after sunset, night. That is the prayer of Islam. Not once a week. I mean, that's Christianity. Once a week, you know. Or whatever, once a month, once in a year. This is not Islam. It's not the prayer of Islam. Prayer, which is spoken about in Islam, which is considered the second pillar of action. This is the established prayer. So when a person abandons the established prayer, they give up prayer. They're not getting up in the morning and praying anymore. So on. So they have stepped out of Islam. Though they may call themselves Muslims. Though their parents are Muslims. Because in Islam, the view is that Islam cannot be inherited. Islam is not by chance. It's by choice. You could say it's by chance that you happen to be born in a Muslim family. You had no choice in that matter. You didn't choose your parents. Just as it was no choice on the part of a Buddhist to be born in a Buddhist family or Hindu in a Hindu family or in a Christian family. And as such, God does not hold you to account, does not reward you for the family which you are born in. What you are judged in accordance with is the choices that you make. God reveals to you his signs as to what is the truth. And if you reject it, then that's the choice that you have made. Regardless of what your name may be or what your family belongs to, you will be judged in accordance with the choices that you. And actually from an Islamic perspective, because some people like to insist, but what if a person believes? If they believe in God, but they are not doing what is required of them, but they do believe. What I would say is that people who think this, they're talking about something which is not real. Something hypothetical. Now in the realm of ideas and philosophy, we can talk about a person who actually and sincerely believes. Because Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, said that whoever declares their faith, says La ilaha illallah, declares his faith, accepting God as the only, Allah is the only true God, worthy of worship, that such a person who says that phrase, who expresses that belief sincerely from their hearts, that they're going to paradise. So people have hung on to this statement and have theorized about a person who actually says this sincerely from his heart, but he doesn't do any action. In fact, from an Islamic perspective, this is not real. This is something hypothetical. Because what they have actually done is they have mixed up knowledge with faith. Knowledge with true belief, sincere belief. And in fact, there is a distinction. These two are not the same. See, because you may have knowledge about a thing. You may know God is one. You may know that Prophet Muhammad is the last messenger of God. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him. You may have knowledge of all this. But that knowledge does not become faith from the Islamic perspective until you act in accordance with that knowledge. If you have the opportunity, if you have the opportunity to act in accordance with that knowledge, you do not do so, then that knowledge does not transform into faith from the Islamic perspective. And that knowledge we call satanic knowledge. Satanic knowledge, why? Because of the fact that from an Islamic perspective, what is considered to be the original sin? We have an original sin, Islam. The original sin is that committed by Satan, as recorded in the Quran, after the creation of Adam, Satan was commanded, along with the angels, to bow to Adam. And he refused to bow to Adam. His reason was he felt that he was better than Adam. As quoted in the Quran, he said, "You created me from fire and you created him from clay. I'm better than you." And of course, from the Islamic perspective, Satan is not considered to be an angel. Satan is not an angel, a fallen angel. Christian theology, he's looked at as a fallen angel. But from the Islamic perspective, no, he belongs to another order of creation who are known as the jinn, who have a choice between right and wrong. They have the ability, free will, to make that choice. Whereas angels are not, or do not have ability to choose between right and wrong. They only do as they're commanded by God. So, Satan disobeyed God. Though he knew God, he knew the oneness of God better than any human being to come. Or at least as well as the prophets of God. He had been elevated to a particular status. He knew that oneness of God. And he knew about his duty to God. However, that knowledge was not transformed into faith. So though he had the knowledge of the oneness of God, his disobedience to God has relegated him to hell. This is why we call it satanic knowledge. So a Muslim, a person who calls himself a Muslim, who says, "I believe," who has the knowledge of what constitutes faith or Islam, but refuses to put that knowledge into practice, that person is heading to hell. Now, it's a very mistaken concept amongst many Muslims that simply because we're Muslims, we're in a Muslim family, our names are Muslim names, you know, and we say that we believe that we're going to paradise. That paradise is a special place for Muslims. But in fact, it is a special place for believers, true believers. Not for everyone who has called himself a Muslim. A very important point. Because so many people have become deluded. You know, this is what has happened to people of in earlier religions, earlier generations, you know, where people get the idea that simply because we say that we accept Jesus as our personal savior, that's it. You know, that's your guaranteed ticket to paradise. This is again that satanic delusion which was introduced by Satan's helper, Paul, to the followers or people who sought to follow the teaching of Jesus. And say before them were the Jews, who thought that they were the chosen people of God. Paradise is for them alone. Only Jews go into paradise. You know, Jew, anybody, as long as you belong in that particular genealogical line, you know, your mother was a Jew, and your mother
father's mother was a Jew, so on, so you're a Jew. And for you is paradise. This is delusion. This is satanic delusion. Satan comes to man and fools him into believing that merely because of his genealogy, or the family that he's born in, or the country that he's from, that this puts him on a special category, gives him a special status. No. All of mankind is on the same level. The only people of special status are those who know God, know who God is, and who apply that knowledge in their life by living lives of righteousness, you know, in consistent with the teachings of the prophets that were sent to man. So, the principle then, which underlies all of the various teachings of Islam, is that of correct faith and correct action. Why I'm adding correct actions here? Because even when we talk about faith without act, faith without act could also include those people who have correct faith in the sense that they have knowledge of who God is, oneness, etc. But their actions involve worshipping other than God. Those actions can also destroy the value of that faith. So a person who may be among the followers of the Prophet, who we believe according to the fundamental teachings of Islam, whoever is a follower of the Prophet, a true follower, is a Muslim, because Muslim means one who submits his will or her will to the will of God. So, the followers of Abraham, true followers of Moses, of Jesus, we consider all to be Muslims. Anyone who comes out of that line of belief, as taught by the Prophet, but who deviates from that belief in their actions, in that they are taking others to be gods besides the one true God. From Islamic perspective, this is what has happened in the case of Christianity, that God who Jesus worshipped is not the God who Christians today worship. Jesus worshipped God in the true sense, full sense, without any intermediaries between himself and God. And this is what he called his disciples and his followers to worship. And this message was not unique to Jesus. It was the same message of Moses, that of Adam, that of Abraham, that of all of the prophets of God. However, the followers in time deviated from these teachings and placed intermediaries between themselves and God. One might be wondering, in the case of Jews who still speak in terms of one God, Yahweh, and don't seem to have any intermediaries, where does the intermediary come in their case? You'll find it in, it's not so much in the Torah, although there are some references in the Torah, you'll find it mostly in their Talmud, which is the book which they give actually more precedence to than the Torah itself. You know, it is something like a commentary on the Talmud, a collection of commentaries on the Talmud. And you'll find in it where the rabbis have been elevated to a point where God consults the rabbis before doing certain things. So God is sort of relegated to be like, he does whatever the Jews want, that he does. You know, in this way, the rabbis have become intermediaries. And this is what is spoken about in the Quran, where they have taken their rabbis and monks, priests, as lords besides God. That they have become intermediaries between them and God. So, if a person among the followers of the Prophet, a person who today calls himself a Muslim, if he sets up an intermediary between himself and God, if he prays to Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, or he prays to somebody he designates as a saint, then he has destroyed faith. By those actions, he has destroyed, or she has destroyed, faith. So, that fundamental principle underlying all of the teachings of Islam is that you must have a combination of correct faith and correct act. For Islam to be acceptable, your submission, because when we say Islam, we're talking about your submission to God, to be acceptable to God. And what this means then for every believer is that, one, it is essential to know who God is. Very clearly. To have no delusions or misunderstandings about who God is. Because when we look around us in the world, what we see is that the vast majority of mankind believes in God. Believes in a supreme being. However, because their knowledge of who that supreme being is distorted, it's not correct, then they have taken the creation of God to be the supreme being, the representative of God, that God is manifest in his creation, either as a tree or a stone, animals of the air, sea, or animals of the land, or human beings. Because of their misunderstanding of who God is, they have taken instead what is closest to their own senses. Now, what is tangible, what appears to them to be tangible. You know, you can touch it. You know, you can touch a tree or a stone or a man. You know, so it makes it seems to be more accessible or more, you know, acceptable or more easily acceptable. This is why you find traditionally in all the various nations around the world where they have concepts of God, you know, God is portrayed in the form of some human being or some animal. You know, who is like a human being. Human being, not even saying God in the form of a human being, that's one thing, but also God being like a human being. He'll have a wife and he will, you know, maybe have relations with other human beings and have half God, half man. And, you know, you read in Greek mythology and Roman mythology and the mythologies of the world, you find this concept very common because they have not understood who God is. So, for correct faith to be there, one needs to know who God is. And our knowledge of God, part of it is given to us. We have it. Every human being has a basic knowledge of God. According to Islamic teachings, we have God stating in the Quran that when he created Adam, he took from Adam all of it. And he made them all bear witness that he, God, was their Lord. And they all bore witness. That is, this has become something imprinted on the soul of every human being. When he is born with a natural or inborn knowledge of God. However the environment, family, sight, whatever, will cloud that and cause him to deviate or her to deviate. But essentially, when born,
child is born with that natural knowledge. And this is called fitra from the point of Islamic teachings. Prophet ﷺ had said that every child is born in this state of fitra, the natural belief of God. However, it's his parents and environment which caused him to deviate from it. So every human being has that. And what happens is that God will show each and every one of us signs that whatever we are believing in, if our beliefs are false, he will show us signs that our beliefs are false. These signs may come in many, many different ways. It doesn't mean, I'm not talking about revelation comes, because we don't believe. Revelation ended with the last of the prophets. That was special for prophets. We don't receive revelation in the sense of prophets receiving revelation. However, God reveals the truth to us through our daily life, incidents in our daily life. And it then becomes up to that person when they find out that what they were believing in was in fact not true. Then it becomes up to them now to start to search. This search has been mentioned in the Quran with regards to Prophet Abraham, you know, where he began at first to worship because of the people worship stars, and then reflecting on it, setting of the stars, he felt that God put God has given us this inner understanding. We have an intellect which can carry us to a large degree, can carry us to God, to one God. If we utilize, as I said, the science that God shows us throughout our lives. And one point, just to illustrate how the sign may come in a very simple way, is if we take, for example, somewhere in the Amazon, South America, the jungle, you know, a particular individual, young man, who has been raised believing that God is a particular idol and tribe worship. And they have a hut, which is the temple in which that God is worshipped. And one day he goes in to worship the God by himself. And a dog comes walking in the hut after him. And dogs, when they feel to urinate, they lift up their legs. So this dog comes by the idol, lifts up his leg, urinates on the idol. This young man, when he sees that, his reaction will be, you know, disgust. Chase the dog out of there. Horrible dog. But that for him could be the sign of God to him. This can't be God. God who is unable to stop a dog from coming and urinating on him. Can this be God? The creator of the universe? See? Such an individual, if he receives such a sign, for example, then now he has to choose. He has seen the sign that this is not God. But for him, to reject this as God means to go against the way of the tribe. And of course, this requires a certain amount of courage and conviction. You know, courage to follow what you know to be true. This is how people become responsible. God shows you in your life the sign that what you're doing is not right. If you know it is not right, then you must act. So, this is just a small illustration of a possible way. God shows each and every one. And when a person realizes, they now are obliged to continue to search to find God. And as God promises, one who seeks him, he will reveal himself to him. Because we do not believe God is unjust in such a way that a person who seeks God, but who, because of the destiny of God, was born in a circumstance where he never heard of Muhammad or Jesus or Moses, that this person now is relegated to hell. No. What is required of this person, in terms of belief, is not the same as is required of those who have been exposed to the teaching. That person, for that person to just come to the realization of the oneness of God and to worship that one God and to do righteousness, knowing that he or she is accountable to God, this is the fundamentals of the teachings of all of the prophets. This is Islam in the very basic level. And this is universal. This is something attainable by anyone, anywhere. So, one, it is necessary for a person, from an Islamic perspective, to have correct. One has to seek that belief out to be certain who God is. Then, after knowing who God is, one is then obliged to put that knowledge into practice, to act in accordance with that knowledge, to worship God. And worshiping God has to be in accordance with teaching of the prophets of God. Where that knowledge is available, then people are required to do so according to the teachings of the prophets. It is not for us to speculate, make up, innovate, and create acts of worship. Such becomes deviation. This again is what has happened in the earlier systems that came before, earlier messages of Islam which came, which was distorted in time by the followers of the earlier prophets. Because they innovated in the religion. They changed the practices so much so that they ended up, though calling themselves followers of those prophets, they ended up worshipping other than God. Believing that they were worshipping God. This is why in Islam, in the final method, so much emphasis has been placed on purity of action. The actions have to be in accordance with the teachings of the prophet. We're not allowed to make any additions to the religion or any subtractions. What was prescribed 1,400 years ago is prescribed today. When the prophet prescribed through the Quran, God's revelation to the prophet, Quran, and in his own statement, the dress of the Muslim woman, for example, that she cover everything of herself, excepting her face and her hands. This dress, which is known as the hijab, this is not something for 1400 years ago. It is something which is to be the dress of the Muslim woman till the end of time. And it did not actually begin at that time. Because if we go back, you know, centuries before, to the time of Prophet Jesus. The women who are around Jesus, when they are portrayed, you know, even to this day amongst Christians, when they make drawings and carvings, and etc., of Mary Magdalene and, you know, Mary the mother of Jesus and others, they always portray them looking like Muslim women, wearing the veils and their long dresses, only seeing their faces. Some people might say, well, oh no, that was the dress, that's the way everybody dresses those days. No! Back then, the Romans, they were known, they used to wear dresses, as their statues portrayed, dresses which were very revealing, exposing large portions of their body. It was not the common dress of them. It was the dress of the righteous. This is what Jesus sanctioned. And the early church, it followed that. Roman Catholic, the nuns. But because of the fact that the religion was left so much up to man, or men intervened in the teachings of and the practices of Jesus, so much so, that that mode of dress changed itself. From the early women of the church, looking just like Muslim women, covering everything except for faces. You know, we find that the dress, called the habit or whatever, you know, it's getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Scarf, you know, getting shorter and shorter, you know, in some cases it's just removed altogether, you know, you have different places in different parts of the world you find variations of it, but the point is that it has modified itself. And similar, for example, the issue of homosexuality.
homosexuality, which the early church, for example, considered up until very recently to be abomination, totally unacceptable. However, in the last 20-odd years, we find homosexuals have become so prominent in Western society that they have now managed to put pressure on the medical profession to no longer say that these people are sick. No, no, in fact, it's maybe something genetic. Or, you know, they're starting to find excuses, find justification. No, people are just born that way, you know, this type of thing, you know. And what comes along with that is that it put pressure on the church. So you even have, in San Francisco, we have, you know, homosexual ministers and homosexual congregations, you know. And on television here, I just saw just a few days ago, they had a homosexual priest from the Catholic Church. You know, and he was defending homosexuality and talking about how widespread it is amongst it. Yeah. I mean, this is what is happening, and more people are accepting it. People in the audience, you know, there were a few people you could see who are still hanging in there saying, no, 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 it's not right, you can't be, you've broken your vows and all, but the majority of the people, no, it's okay, what's wrong, there's nothing, you know, the man is a good man. And all. So the society is coming to the point where homosexuality has become acceptable. Where the Islamic teaching is clear. Homosexuality is not a genetic, does not have a genetic origin. It is a choice that a person makes. It is a sin, as adultery, as fornication is a sin. No change. It was a sin 1400 years ago. It was a sin in the time of Moses. It is a sin today. Muslims will never take the position that homosexuals can homosexuality can become acceptable in society. Such people, if they're caught in the act, according to Islamic law, just as a person who commits adultery, they are executed. But if a person is sick, they have these tendencies, they seek treatment, of course Islam doesn't say we just round them all up and, you know, execute them, so like this. This is the same way you wouldn't round up all sinners and just, you know. But a person who's sick, they're given treatment. But we don't look at it as anything other than a sickness. Prophet Lot, I mean, this was the story of Prophet Lot. This is what happened to those people. You know, as described in the Quran, these people had deviated. Homosexuality had become the order of the day amongst the people to whom Prophet Lot was. They were destroyed because of it. It is a sin. It is corruption and evil. So, what is good, what is evil, has been defined by God, and it has to remain that way. The act of worship, wherein we seek to please God and to avoid His displeasure, acts of worship which we do out of a need that we have, not out of a need that God has, these acts have been clearly defined for us by the Prophet of God. The last Prophet Muhammad, may God be blessed upon him, identified all that there is to do in terms of God. As he said, مَا تَرَكْتُ شَيْئًا يُقَرِّبُكُمْ إِلَى اللَّهِ إِلَّا وَأَمَرْتُكُمْ بِهِ. I did not leave anything which will bring you closer to God except that I have told you to do it. That's it. Complete. So, from the Islamic perspective, we have correct faith, which hinges on knowledge of who God is, and correct action, which is acting in accordance with the teaching of the Prophet. And there are two other principles with regards to acts, which I'd just like to mention before stopping and opportunity to discuss some of what I've presented. And that is that for acts to be acceptable to God, they must be sincere. They must be done in accordance or seeking the pleasure of God. That to do an act, for example, the act specified in Islam, there's prayer, charity, fasting, etc. To do these acts as a ritual, because we all do it, our families do it, and so on and so on, just to do it. These acts become useless. They will not carry us or give us access to paradise. They have to be done sincerely for the pleasure of God. And in doing it for the pleasure of God, then it is possible to do the act according to the spirit that was intended by the act. What do I mean by that? I mean that we have fasting in Islam, particularly the compulsory fast of Ramadan, the ninth lunar month, wherein we fast those 30 days, 29 or 30 days, wherein we do not eat, drink anything, or do not have any sexual relations from dawn till sunset. Now, that is the ritual of the fast. But at the same time, we're also instructed that during the fast, you should not engage in any form of backbiting, cursing, all these different things, because this can also destroy the value of the fast. So there is the general ritual that we have to do, in the sense that we stop eating at a certain point and we begin again at another point. We prevent ourselves from taking drinks, having sexual relations, etc. But furthermore, we also have to control our tongues, how we use our tongues, or how, our thoughts. We seek to control our thoughts during that period. Not that we only control it during Ramadan and then the rest of Ramadan we don't, but this is just a training period. Like every year you have a course which you revise your practices, strengthen them during that period. But furthermore, we also have to consider that you have some people in Muslim land who will stay up all night, eat, party during Ramadan, and then after they take, start the fast, they sleep.